Thanks for coming out this evening to hear Alexander Saxon speak at the Marxist School of Sacramento. We are very honored to have Alex Saxon as our speaker tonight. We're beginning our eighth year here at the Marxist School of Sacramento. It's hard to believe, but 8 years and we're still going. I won't overstate it to say we're going strong, but we're still going. Okay. Now, tonight, the title of, let me say just a little bit about Alex Saxon. He is an historian, he's a novelist, he is a retired professor of history at UCLA, and he's written a fascinating book that's available in the back titled Religion and the Human Prospect. It's a very interesting work. I've read it, and I heartily recommend all of you reading Alex's book as well. He worked on it beginning in 1990 when he retired, and he really covers from a left labor Marxist framework analysis the big questions of our time. And without any further ado, let's welcome Alexander Saxon, who will give us a talk on Marxism and the Great God Debate.
And then my next book as a historian was on the theme of behind the construction? What were the historical reasons for the construction of white racism that became so crucially important in American history, both labor history and the history of the country as a whole? So those were the things I was working on most of my professional life. When I retired in 1990, it wasn't that those themes had been settled or that I thought that there wasn't more to be said about them, but I was convinced that by what was going on, that the question of religion had become an equally important question in the fate of the human species. And so I began thinking about religion and began working on a book on religion, which I worked on, well, that was 1990, and we're now 2007. The book was published a year and a half ago. So I worked on that for about 15 years. It was a major project. Prior to that, I really knew nothing about religion. That's one reason why it took me 15 years, because I had to learn a lot of stuff that I didn't know. Now, I don't mean that I came out of a non-religious background. My family was Catholic, grew up, as I say, in New York. But by the time I was an adolescent and was becoming a Marxist, I had left religion behind me and regarded it as totally unimportant and not something that one needed to be concerned about. But by the 1990s, it seemed to be obvious in the world and in this country that religion was becoming crucially important and that it was playing a devastatingly bad role in the hopes and prospects of the human species. So that brings me to the topic of the book. Actually, the topic of the book is not the great God debate, but it's an effort to construct a historical essay. Since there are many historical essays on religion, I hasten to add to that from a secular and critical point of view on the role of religion in human history and human culture. That's the theme of the book. But what I had suggested talking about tonight was the great God debate, which is a closely related subject. And what I'm referring to here is since the turn of the century, of the present century, there has been an increasing series of treatments of religion, which in American history is unique. Nothing like it has happened since the 1890s, when you had Mark Twain and Robert Ingersoll and Jack London, all world-class non-believers and writing for mass audiences, of course speaking to mass audiences, and often speaking very critically, particularly Robert Ingersoll, whose whole later part of his life was devoted to criticism of religion. He used to love to go around to small towns and challenge all the local priests and ministers come out to debate, and he would then, he would then pin their back to the wall. He was very skillful and very effective. But that was the 1890s, and that was back in a long time ago. That was, shall we say, at the height of the period that historians often refer to as the era of secularization, which came to an end really at the end of the Second World War. So that since the end of the Second World War, I, as being in my 80s, grew up and was an adolescent in the last 20 years or so of the secular era, in which religion in the West, at least, I mean in Europe and the United States, was at its perhaps lowest point of popular acceptance in all of its history. But for a number of reasons, I won't try to say what I think those were, and we can talk about what the reasons were later on if there's some questions in that direction. For a number of reasons, after the end of the Second World War, you had a resurgence of religion in this country and in other places too, which has increased, and religion has become increasingly dominant in human affairs and in the politics and the economic relationships of the world since the end of the Second World War. The Great God Debate begins about the beginning of this of the 21st century, and has been unique in bringing atheism and atheist treatments of religion to the bestseller list, as I say, for the first time since the 1890s. So you have authors like Richard Dawkins of the English scientist, Sam Harris, a scientist and evolutionary biologist and I have to take a look at my written notes here. E.O. Wilson, of course, the famous evolutionist and biologist at Harvard, and Daniel Dennett, a specialist in the study of cognitive science. All of these writing books from an atheist point of view, and several of them reaching the bestseller list. So this has been a unique development in American cultural history, and something that we would have to go back a long way in time to come to something comparable about it. Now what I want to do is say a few words about the argument that has been developed by these people writing on religion, and to suggest some of the weaknesses that it has, and what, in my view, is lacking about it, and what, in my book, I tried to provide. Of course, my book was written before most of these were, because I was working on it, as I say, for the past 15 years. All of these writers are scientists or philosophers. And they're all, I'm speaking of the writers who are critical of religion, and of course there have been a great many books that have been defenses and advocacies of religion. So we've got a debate going on with these atheist science writers playing a central role, and playing a very important role in a situation in which atheists have not had much prior hearing in the United States. Their books have played an important role and had the effect, certainly, of making atheism more visible than it was previously. But they have had a number of weaknesses, I think, for the following reasons. The lack, it seems to me, of these books, critical of religion, defending atheism, asserting atheism, written by scientists, is that they assume that if you provide a scientific and logical refutation of religion, that takes care of it, that then people will be persuaded, and that if you can show that religion is illogical and unscientific, that then people are automatically going to give up religion. But of course that's not the case, that's a fallacy. And people don't give up religion, they continue to believe, because the belief has a different kind of a structure from that of a scientific, logical argument. So there is this weakness about the presentation of the atheist contributions, the atheist writings have. And I would, let me put it this way, the weakness of this argument is that it brings forward no explanation for the universality of religious belief. That if you can provide a scientific refutation or a logical refutation of religion, but this provides no explanation for how religion, that's why religion, became so dominant in human culture. And everybody, both pro and con on religion, I think, agrees, and this is certainly historically demonstrative. The that religion has indeed been universal to almost all societies throughout history. And anthropologists and archaeologists have discovered no, or historians have discovered no trace of any society that didn't have some form of religious acceptance. Now, actually, this amounts to the strongest argument for religion, for religious believers. That is, if you can say that religion is universally held, what sort of explanation can you offer for that other than that, well, God made religion and God made people receptive to religion? So the universality of religion, which everyone agrees to, is one of the strongest arguments for religion. But this is precisely what the scientific and logical arguments don't get to. What you need there is a historical argument. And of course, I'm beating my own drums here because I am a historian. I was never a historian of religion until rather recently. But what one needs as a refutation of religion is a historical, secular, persuasive explanation of how and why religion became universally accepted in human culture. So this is essentially what I've tried to do in my book, and I will give a couple of comments on that. I won't attempt to reconstruct the whole argument here, but I begin with the acceptance of a definition of religion that actually goes back to the mid-19th century and was proposed by an anthropologist who's often described as the father of British anthropology, Tylor, who was a study of took up the, amongst other things, the study of the origins of religion and established a definition of religion which is quite widely accepted still, perhaps the most widely accepted. And that is that religion is belief in spiritual beings. I would add to that a belief in spiritual beings who take an anthropomorphic form. So religion is belief in spiritual beings, but how did that come about in an evolutionary sense? Well, to answer that question is beyond the reach of historians and probably beyond the reach of anthropologists, because it takes us back to the very earliest moments of the existence of the human species, and perhaps even earlier than that, as evolutionary biologists would now tell us. That is, there may have been biological evolutionary developments that laid the basis for religion, in the same way that we have learned, say, from Noam Chomsky, that biological evolutionary developments established the ability in all human beings to construct, that is, speak language. So we can, but this is beyond the reach of any historical evidence or any evidence that we're going to find in a written or even archaeological form. So one has to begin with a hypothetical explanation for the beginning of religion. And the hypothetical explanation may not be accurate. There may be several hypothetical explanations, any of which might work, but we need a hypothesis to begin with, and one that is persuasive, but is not demonstrable in the sense that we can find an absolute proof in either historical or scientific terms of it. So my hypothesis is that the belief in spiritual beings began at the evolutionary moment when the human species, or predecessors of the human species, arrived at that state of biological development, which we can call consciousness. Consciousness is something that scientists are ferociously studying now in various different ways, and they're quite a long way still from understanding. But if we think of consciousness as something that developed in an evolutionary sense, we can think of a moment at which consciousness made the first humans, or the first pre-humans, or whatever one, however far back one wants to push it, aware of themselves as persons, creatures, acting and acting deliberately and made them able to be aware of the process of mind that went along with their actions and made them also perceptive of what was happening to other people and other creatures. So that when you become, when you arrive at a state of consciousness, you necessarily had to arrive at the awareness of death and of the inevitability of death. And so far as we know, this is a perception that other than human species is not felt by any living creatures. So this is a unique aspect of the human experience in which the knowledge of death is opened up by the evolutionary development of consciousness. Now, the knowledge of, well, let me start with a different line there. The consciousness is enormously valuable. It was an enormously important attribute of the human species and worked adaptively for the benefit of the human species, because it gave to human beings who were conscious of their acts the ability to plan their acts, and therefore gave them an enormous competitive advantage, I'm talking in Darwinian terms now, over other species that were not conscious. And out of consciousness comes the development of human culture, which we can say is the greatest adaptive advantage that the human species has over all other living creatures. And it's through human culture that the human species arrives at, this can be good or bad perhaps, arrives at the top of the food chain and becomes the dominant species, the dominant force in control of the earth on which we live. So culture and culture developing out of consciousness become enormously important as simply as biological equipment for the survival and dominance of the human species. Now, religion then enters the structure of culture at the point where consciousness recognizes the necessity of death, and the necessity of death and the knowledge of death. Of course, all animals encounter death, or many encounter death, and many animals in their daily life are constantly threatened, or very often threatened with death. But for an animal that was not aware of the necessity of death, one particular anthropologist gives the example of the gazelles that are grazing in the field, and the lion is waiting in the backdrops, and they're aware of the lion, but they go on feeding. Now, when the lion attacks one of them, perhaps that one gets killed, and the others run off, but then they have to continue feeding, and presumably they are able to, or not aware of, in between times, the threat of the lion. But when you get consciousness at the human level, this is no longer possible. So that the human being lives with the constant knowledge of death, I'm talking about this in retrospective terms, lives with the consciousness of death. And the consciousness of death can be a scary and destructive kind of knowledge. So the explanation, the hypothetical explanation that I propose, this is not original with me, actually it goes way, way back to Greek philosophy, that religion interposes between consciousness and the fear of death the belief in spiritual beings who provide a sense of harmony, a sense of oneness between the human being, the human consciousness, and nature out here, nature being the realm of danger and death. But if you believe that nature is governed by spiritual beings, and what's the origin of those spiritual beings? Well, in my view at least, the origins of those spiritual beings is the human mind, the human consciousness. So this is a projection. intersection of human hopes into nature, and the expectation, belief, and hope that nature will be harmonious, that nature will deal with us in a kind of way. And this seems to me an essential ingredient in an explanation of religion. Now, having gotten to that point, then our next question is, how does that become a universal characteristic of all human culture? And this, I think, is the question that the atheist scientists who have been the big bestsellers, or some of amongst the big bestsellers in the great God debate, have not adequately answered. My answer would be along these lines, that if belief in a harmonious force in nature is held by some particular individual, say a human tribe, that person who believes that is going to have an advantage over people who don't believe, because things will go better, and the action of that person will be more effective in hunting or gathering or wooing or finding mates or establishing relationships within the tribe and so forth. So that the belief in spiritual beings becomes an asset to the individual organism that holds it, and therefore leads to the success of that individual organism, and the success of that individual human being within a tribal group. So the success of that person brings that person to the top and brings their children to the top. One doesn't need really to argue very much about whether we're doing this solely in genetic. I'm talking really about the cultural transmission, but genetic transmission also can become part of it, because the person who is successful in religious terms and, say, becomes the leader of the group is also going to be pass on that those same traits to children, both in a genetic form and in the form of cultural transmission. So that within a single group, religion, once it's established, is likely to become, I would say almost certainly, become dominant in that group. Now, if you bring two groups together, and we know enough about the beginnings of early human society to know that humans lived in small tribes, and that the tribes were rather widely separated, and that they were frequently in competition, and that moral identification existed within the tribe, but generally did not apply to other tribal groups that were enemies, unless they were closely related. So if you bring two tribes into conflict over a hunting ground, and one of them is religious and believes that nature is going to give guidance and leadership to the believers, and the other one hasn't learned about religion, I think it's almost inevitable that the group that has the religion is going to win out, because the religion and the impact of religion will give greater effectiveness and greater cooperative ability within the group. So we can push this step by step to the point where religion spreads within each group, and the religious groups prevail over other groups. And before long, religion is becoming more and more widely spread. So I think this is the, I will pursue this argument further, except to say that this exemplifies the kind of argument that I'm trying to develop to explain why religion is universal in human culture. Now, one of the difficulties with all of the scientific records that we've been writing these books on atheism is that they not only have no explanation of how religion became universal in human culture, but that they do not have an explanation groping for words here, They do not have an explanation of bear with me for just a minute here. The problem I'm trying to formulate is this, is that if religion is as bad as these writers say it is, and I agree with them ultimately that it is, then how can one explain how religion became universal? And how can one explain how it continued throughout the development of history to be beneficial and adaptive for human society? And I will offer in my book two particular case examples of this. Religion, I think almost everyone who writes about religion, certainly this is true of Marx's treatments of religion, sees religion as playing an important role in the development of class exploitation and gender exploitation. How does religion do this? Well, it does this because once you have a society that believes in religion, it tends to develop specialists in religion who become a professional group within the group. And this becomes, because it controls an important part of the properties of these, shall we say, of the society, become leading people within the group. So the priests and clerical hierarchies play a very powerful and important role. And because of their class position, they tend to become part of the ruling class within that society. So that in almost every historical situation that I think has been studied or could be studied, the hierarchy, the priestly hierarchy within societies, becomes a defender of the status quo and of the upper classes within that society. So that religion tends to become a defender of exploitation, class exploitation, and gender exploitation. Now, one might say that this is a dysfunctional thing, and not very good for from the point of view of adaptability, or that it's not good for the species. But if one pushes that a little bit further, and here is where you need a historical approach, which I would say the scientist writers generally don't have or don't arrive at. It is clear that exploitation, labor exploitation, gender exploitation, play an enormous role in the development of human culture and society. The fact is, we would not have civilization if there had not been exploitation, because the degree, the productive power of the human species was never great enough to produce enough to go all the way around. So there would have been no religion, no law, no literature developed, if there had not been a leisure class to develop. And the leisure class was made possible because of the exploitation by gender by gender and labor exploitation. So the development of civilization and of culture owes a great deal to religion, although, and to exploitation, although neither of these are very desirable traits, and both of them have very negative effects. Nonetheless, civilization could hardly have developed without them. Another example is taking the divisiveness of religion. One of the accusations made against religion is that it divides people by enabling them to see their opponents, political opponents, social opponents, whatever, as agents of the evil empire, and to turn any kind of a dispute that might otherwise be simply a political or economic dispute into a crusade, into a holy war, by saying, well, these people are agents of the bad one, agents of the devil. Otherwise, they wouldn't behave the way they do. Therefore, it's our obligation to destroy them, to wipe them out. This has a good deal to do, or a good deal of resemblance, to the attitude towards Islam in this country today, the Islamic faith, that these people are enemies, and we can identify them as agents of the evil empire. I could practically quote Bush directly on that, and certainly some other presidents who have made similar statements about our opponents politically. So religion is divisive, one might add, encourages, enhances, turning what would otherwise be simply, well, I won't say simply, because they could be pretty important, but simply disputes at the level of politics or economics into holy wars, into religious crusades. This might seem to be dysfunctional and very bad, but let's think about it for a minute. War has played an enormously important part in the development of human culture. We know from our own very recent experience that a good deal of this high tech here comes out of what was developed in the Second World War and subsequently. We know that our whole computer apparatus, we know that radar and so forth, are all culturally developed out of the pressures of preparation for war. If we push back a little bit in time, we could give many other examples of ways in which war and the prevalence of war has stimulated science and cultural growth. Now, that works effectively, and at the end of what each particular war, the scientific advances that have been made during that period, become the general property, so that the advances that are made during war, our advances in rocketry, for example, become the property of human society as a whole. So that war has played a stimulating effect on the development of culture and civilization. And religion has been crucial to the spread of war because of its enabling different groups to be religiously hostile, religiously condemning of other groups. So that religion has become an encourager of war. And this has been in human history so far advantageous to the development of culture, because in culture, the human species, with the powers that have accrued to it in part through the development of war, increases its domination over the global food chain as a whole. So how long does that go on? Well, what I want to say here is that these beneficial effects of religion are limited to a particular time, historical time period. It was a very long historical time period, beginning with the beginning of human history, and coming up until a rather recent time, coming up until when? Well, actually coming up until the end of the Second World War. What happened at the end of the Second World War? Two crucially important things. The development of atomic and later nuclear energy made it clear that divisive wars, however beneficial they may be to culture, have the power to destroy all life on Earth. And the second point, that the development of industrialization, which is the economic and organizational turn of history, that made possible for the first time in human history the production of enough to support everybody in human society. That industrialization which had brought the powers of the Second World War and the powers we hoped for after the Second World War to end poverty globally, is also associated with the discovery that occurred shortly after the Second World War of ecological limits, of the ecological burnout. So we can relate this to the C.M. Robbins, Rachel Carson, for example, and other writers of that time, who made us aware in the decades that followed the Second World War that industrial growth was destroying the biological envelope in which all life, including human life, existed. So it's at this point that the historical period within which religion could work adaptively, beneficially for human culture, came to an abrupt end. And it is at this point that religion becomes, instead of adaptive to human culture and human society, destructive both of human society and of potentially life on earth. So the religion in the period, what I am trying to construct in my argument is an explanation of why over the long time period religion became universal, why it worked adaptively for human society, and why in our modern it becomes potentially and actually extremely dangerous and destructive, and becomes a factor in the potential, and I think, well, let's not say inevitable, but certainly likely devastation that nuclear weapons of mass destruction and ecological are likely to visit our society. I haven't been timing myself, but I think that's where I would like to stop and see if anyone wants to come in with questions.
Oh, are you familiar with Wendell Berry's critique of...
With whose critique?
Wendell Berry's critique.
Yes.
Of Wilson's Consilius.
Of Wilson?
I think it's E.F. Wilson.
Yes. Well, when I say familiar, I can't cite it off the top of my head,
right,
but I have read it there.
Yeah. Well, he attacks him, not necessarily familiar, he attacks the positivism of modern science and Wilson's desire to subsume all fields of human knowledge within the scientific positivistic framework, but it's a devastating critique.
Yes.
And he comes to that critique from a religious point of view. So I don't know how important his religion is in the clarity and power of his critique of Wilson. I thought maybe be familiar enough with it to deal with that, but I think if you think mainly he's critiquing, like Marx did, the early positivists in their atheism as being sort of shackled to the just as religion often is to the power structure and class system. And not really freeing the human mind, but kind of imprisoning it within that. In other words, a scientific point of view, he points out, can it just as imprison the human mind in a closet, it's really just positivistically vulgar materialism, as a religious point of view, if it wishes to do so. Anyway, I'm talking.
Have you read E.O. Wilson's book, Creation?
No.
That's one of the best sellers. E.O. Wilson is outspoken in his assertion of atheism, but in this book, he's not making that his theme. In fact, that never has been his theme. His theme is an appeal to particularly fundamentalist ministers. He comes himself from a Southern Baptist background, to join with scientists in trying to save the envelope of nature within which human and all other life exists. And this urging pastors to ally with scientists, not to debate religion or not religion, but to save the ecology of the world. Wilson at least is reaching out to attempt to make a contact. I totally agree that that is a difficulty of communication. Well, that's more thing that I've come to say about that later on. But switch to a slightly different strand of the same theme. I think the chapter that I wrote last in the book is entitled "The Failed Critique of Marxism and Failed Critique of Religion," in which I am critical of Marx, but particularly later Marxists. I think Marx had a good reason not to pursue it, for not pursuing, and Engels too, their initial focus on religion, which is very strong in their earlier, younger period. But they became dedicated to writing their critique of capitalism, which was crucial, and they were getting old, and they were running out of money, and health, and so forth. So they never completed the critique of religion, and other Marxists did not, I think, unfortunately. So Marxism never really came to a conclusion on how to cope with religion. The initial thrust of your question, but I am aware of some of those things, and I'm also aware of the problem that it poses as between, say, liberation theology and the kind of critique of religion that I'm proposing. I think one of the reasons I had a lot of difficulty getting a publisher for my book was that the left-wing publishers were somewhat unenthusiastic about it, I think, for reasons that are similar to what you're saying. When Lindsay Review published the book, they just about at the same time brought out a book about Chavez in Venezuela, in which the front page illustration shows Chavez giving a speech to a group of working class supporters with a crucifix in hand, a revival of liberationist theology. So that for a publisher like this, it was applied to Verso, published my previous book, but turned down the book on religion, and so on. Marx as a publisher. Am I ready? What did you say? Oh, okay. Let me finish my sentence. Verso, I think, probably for that reason, didn't want to do the book, and Monthly Review, for that reason, hesitated a long time